as I said, our aspiration is to solve the hydrogen value chain problem, right? And there's a lot of people who want to build hydrogen airplanes. There's a lot of people who want to build engines for hydrogen airplanes, right? And there's nobody who wants to be a hydrogen fuel services provider. And so, in terms of addressing an unmet need, we are very happy with this niche that we think we figured out a very elegant way of addressing, right? We have very strong intellectual property and competitive moats around the solution. And so we see that as a great business for Universal Hydrogen. If we get into the airplane business, we're competing with our own customers. Why do
that? Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Paul Ermenko, the CEO and co-founder of Universal Hydrogen. Paul is convinced that hydrogen is the answer to not just making aviation net zero, but carbon neutral. Paul is not making a hydrogen aircraft. He's not making a hydrogen engine, but instead he is rethinking how hydrogen can be transported and loaded onto aircraft in a safe manner. He's already experimenting with Air New Zealand. He is running pilots with ATR. And there are some very exciting plans that Paul shares with us today. We are speaking today with Paul Ermenko of Universal Hydrogen. Paul, hydrogen is meant to be this big savior for the long-term future of carbon neutral flying. And you are the knight in the shining armor trying to carry us through to this vision. Earlier this year, you flew a converted ATR-72 called Lightning McClean with a hydrogen electric part in. Tell us a bit about that test and how your test program is progressing at Universal Hydrogen.
Yeah, absolutely. Just as a minor point of correction, it was actually a Dash 8 that we flew, not an ATR-72, but same class of aircraft. And in fact, it's a natural mistake to make because the first product will be an ATR-72 for us. We use the Dash 8 as a flight test platform, actually because it has a very large vertical tailplane. So in the case of asymmetric thrust, because we're testing one engine running on hydrogen, much easier to control, much better for safety of flight. Same class of aircraft, right? So we're talking 40 to 60 passenger regional airplanes here. And same power level, importantly, which is about 2 megawatts per side in the product configuration.
So why wouldn't you go live with the Dash 8 as opposed to an ADR then?
Because the Dash 8's out of production, right? So it is a relatively old aircraft. The fleet is smaller, right? This is a Dash 8 300, so it's even a subset of all of the different Dash 8 variant fleets. ATR-72 is a much newer aircraft. It's the 600 is very much in production with quite a bit of demand, and we actually expect to be able to stimulate quite a bit of additional demand, maybe to the point where de Havilland will bring the Dash 8 back into production. We've certainly had those conversations with them, but today the nominal plan is we pursue the ATR-72 as the first. This is being done as an STC for those regional airplanes, a supplemental type certificate. Right. And so we expect that after the first STC, whatever airplane that is, again, the plan of record is ATR-72-600, subsequent STCs will be relatively straightforward, right, because the cert basis will be very similar, right? There'll just be a little bit of difference in the physical architecture.
So just for clarification, for those who may not be very familiar with this, if you are you aiming for certification then on the Dash 8? And if you get certified for the Dash 8, can you take that certification over to the ATR?
Yeah, sorry if I created some confusion. No, the certification will be on the ATR-72, and the entry into service will be on the ATR-72. We use the Dash 8 as our first flying testbed. That is not the certification aircraft that we're flying today. It's just a flying testbed for the hydrogen powertrain. We actually have a second airplane in Toulouse. So the company is split about half and half between the US, Los Angeles, and Toulouse. And in Toulouse, we have a second airplane where we do all of the modular fueling system development and testing on that aircraft. That one actually is an ATR-72. And then there will be a flying test bed, sort of a Gen 2 flying test bed, coming next year, which will be the product configured aircraft that combines both the powertrain that we're testing today on the Dash 8 and the modules that we're testing today on the ATR.
Got it. I'm going off on a tangent here, but you mentioned half the companies in Toulouse, half is in the US. Why the split?
The split is so that we can capture the best talent on both continents, right? And if we could, and maybe one day before long we will, right? We would love to have an outpost in Asia as well. But for the moment, those are the two places where we have the most enthusiasm, and we want to be able to attract the best talent, right? So Toulouse is a great city, great quality of life, near the mountains, near the ocean, right, near wine country. Mild weather, and so it's and very reasonable cost of living, so it's easy to attract talent from across Europe to come to Toulouse. And LA, I think, has many of those same attributes, right? It's easy to get people to come here.
Cost of living and traffic is a different ballgame altogether, but perhaps hydrogen airplanes can address that in the future. Now, I actually had your co-founder, John Paul, on the show during the first season, and the emphasis was very much on building the infrastructure for storage and transport of hydrogen. Has your mission now shifted to retrofitting aircraft?
No, the mission is very much around hydrogen fuel logistics, right? That is who we are as a company. That's why the name of the company, Universal Hydrogen, almost sounds like we're a utility, right? Because that is exactly who we aspire to be. But the issue is, and you know, I like to analogize our business model a lot to the Nespresso coffee model, right? Because the big idea in which this company was founded was modular delivery of hydrogen. But we're not a hydrogen producer. We don't want to compete with existing hydrogen producers. We buy the hydrogen in the same way that Nespresso doesn't grow the coffee. They buy the coffee, right? They package it in a convenient modular form factor. They use existing freight network to deliver that convenient form factor to the end customer. Right, so we do exactly the same thing. But as with Nespresso, they had to build the first coffee maker, right? Otherwise, your coffee capsules are completely useless if you can't plug them into a coffee maker. And so similarly, we didn't want to have a hydrogen infrastructure solution waiting around for somebody to get to building a hydrogen airplane that's compatible with our modular capsules. And so for the first product, we are in effect building the coffee maker, which is this retrofit conversion kit for the ATR-72 and maybe for some other models of regional airplanes, as we discussed. But in general, that is not the core business of the company. We don't want to be an engine company. We don't want to be a retrofit company. We don't want to be an airplane company. We are a hydrogen fuel services provider using this modular form factor to make it so that every airport is hydrogen ready if they have cargo handling equipment.
So if you're, you know, in the business of transport and storage and the modular, you know, providing of hydrogen, who's your customer? Is it the airlines? Is it the manufacturers like ATR? Is it the airport? Because, you know, storage of hydrogen at airports is a big issue. Who are you selling to?
So it is in the vast majority of cases, the end customer is the airline, as they are today for fuel services contracts, right? So airlines today will buy fuel, right, from the likes of Air BP, right, or Exxon Aviation, right? All of the major fossil fuel companies have some kind of air aviation services arm, right? And airlines will typically just have a fuel services agreement. So we slot into that exact same framework, and we offer a fuel services agreement for hydrogen delivery to airlines. It just happens to be, instead of being delivered with a fuel truck, it's delivered as a freight module, right, that plugs into the aircraft.
So then the airports really don't come into the picture here about, you know, building hydrogen storage and things like that in your case.
Yeah, there's no real change to the airport. Now, obviously, if all of the airplanes at the airport are using our technology, you will need a lot of sort of storage space, right? It is a little bit different. It does reconfigure a little bit the airport, but that's a little ways down the road, right? For the early adopters, when you might have a regional airline, right, that operates into an airport alongside many others, the impact is pretty minimal. Right, in terms of needing to store these modules, needing to have additional cargo equipment, there's not a huge reconfiguration necessary in the near term or even in the medium term.
Right. So let's talk about customers then. You mentioned your customer is the airline. In the airline world, you've recently signed a deal with ATR and Connect Airways. How's that going to work? Tell us exactly what that, you know, vision going live looks like.
Sure, yeah. So Connect is one of our launch customers. All in all, we have, I think, 16 customers across 12 countries, totaling to date, I think, 247 orders. For this is for regional aircraft conversions and then fuel services for those converted airplanes. Connect is one of our bigger customers, and they will be the launch customer for the U.S. And so the expectation now, Connect is today mainly a charter operator. They're in the process of getting their scheduled airline operations certification, and they want to be the world's first zero emissions airline. Right, so this is really central to their strategy. They have feeder agreements with at least two major carriers that I'm aware of. I don't know if those are public, so I'm not going to name them, but they are well recognized major network carriers. And so Connect plans to put in service a fairly significant number, perhaps up to 100, maybe even a little bit over 100. Of these reconfigured ATR 72s, as soon as we can get the FAA to issue the supplemental type certificate, which we hope is 2025, may end up slipping into 2026. But in any case, it's about 3 years away.
You're saying as soon as 2025 or 2026, we might be able to fly a completely carbon neutral hydrogen airline in the U.S.
In fact, it's better than carbon neutral. It's zero carbon, right? Right. Carbon neutral is usually the language that people use when they're offsetting. Right. They say, OK, I still emit a bunch of CO2, but I'm going to try to offset it somewhere. Right. Like with sustainable aviation fuels. Right. Where I'm going to try to suck up some carbon in the production of the fuel. This is not that. This is a true zero solution. Right. Because the fuel is produced using renewable electricity. This is green hydrogen and water electrolysis. So you break water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen with renewable electricity. And then it's put through a fuel cell on the aircraft, which emits nothing but water.
Wow. So this is true zero, not net zero. Thank you for clarifying that. We recently published a dictionary on sustainable aviation terms just to clarify, because it's like a wild west out there. There's so much confusion with all these terms. You mentioned green hydrogen, and I remember with John Paul, we had a nice explainer on blue, green, gray, all the different types of hydrogen. Now, green hydrogen, of course, is what will ultimately lead to true zero operations. But green hydrogen has two issues. One, it's extremely expensive. Second, there's not enough of it. So where is all of this going to come from, especially because aviation gets the flag that it uses more than its fair share of renewable resources in getting to green hydrogen?
Yeah, so first of all, the cost of green hydrogen has been on an exponentially decreasing trajectory. And the volume has been on a commensurately exponentially increasing trajectory, the production volume. Look, the process is very simple, right? You use renewable electricity, you run it through an electrolyzer. An electrolyzer is basically a fuel cell running backwards, right? and you get hydrogen and oxygen on the back end. The main cost driver for the cost of green hydrogen is the cost of renewable electricity. And so the exponential decrease in the cost of green hydrogen is largely a function of a very rapidly decreasing cost of renewables, and particularly off-peak renewables, right? Because you build a wind farm, you size it for peak power demand on the grid, and when you're off-peak, you dump the power, right? Because the wind keeps blowing, right? But there's no storage mechanism in the grid built into the grid today. And running electrolyzers is actually a pretty good way to harvest that off-peak electricity. Right, so that's been the trend that green hydrogen has been riding. Of course, there's the cost of the electrolyzer itself and amortization of that, and that with volume, of course, the cost drops dramatically. So we think this is a pretty sustainable trend, and we see the cost of green hydrogen without subsidies being at parity with jet fuel in the mid-2020s. Right, and if you layer subsidies on top of that, and there's a massive subsidy in the U.S. as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA that passed last fall. $3 per kilo for green hydrogen, that erases a significant portion of the cost stack for green hydrogen. So the cost is increasingly competitive, and we also see these incentives like the IRA promoting, of course, much more production to come online. There's a lag. There's a 2 to 3 year lag in most parts of the world. It's worse in Europe because the bureaucracy is a lot worse. But in the US and in much of the developing world, there's a 2 to 3 year latency between when somebody wants to start, when there's enough demand and the economics work for a hydrogen project before it can be permitted and put online. Right. But so we do expect to see in the next 2 to 3 years, an avalanche of hydrogen, of green hydrogen production capacity coming online. And we are, of course, actively buying offtake from that hydrogen capacity because we have one of the most compelling use cases. Right. Because aviation has really no other alternative. And it also has one of the higher willingness to pay compared to steel production, right? Other uses for hydrogen in steel production or in ground transportation, right? Aviation is the premium transport modality. And so even without trying to increase passenger airfares, it certainly is a sector with the highest willingness to pay.
This is very interesting. I was at the Boeing SAF forum recently. And it was all about sustainable aviation fuel and how that's going to be the future, especially in the short to medium term. And the challenge there was the price premium. The green premium for SAF is way more. It's 3x to 8x for sustainable aviation fuel. Now, what you're telling me is without subsidy, green hydrogen will be at par with jet fuel in mid-2020s. With subsidies, it might actually be cheaper than jet fuel in some parts of the world. What's the why then the gold rush towards SAF? Why doesn't everyone just come towards green hydrogen and work with you and ZeroAvia and the others?
Yeah, well, that is a very good question. And I think that there's sort of two underlying reasons worth teasing out. So one reason is that the industry is very risk averse, right? The aviation industry. And so what we see with SAF is basically, right, and I apologize if this sounds a little cartoonish, right, but I think it is kind of cartoonish, is the industry saying, we don't want to change the airplane, we don't want to change the engine, let's make this somebody else's problem. This is a fuel industry problem. They give us the same hydrocarbon that they've always given us, right, but they're going to produce it in some way that offsets some of the ill effects of us burning that hydrocarbon at 35,000 feet. And the offsetting is very partial. Right, in terms of so the degree of sustainability of sustainable aviation fuels is very questionable, right? And functionally, a sustainable aviation fuel is the same thing as digging up fossil fuel, using fossil fuel, and paying somebody to plant trees in the Amazon or run a direct air capture machine or doing something like that, right? The good is functionally equivalent to that. And I think the industry doesn't like when I say this, right? So I don't have a lot of friends in the old guard, certainly in the industry, for saying this. Right. But it's true. Right. The emperor has no clothes. Right. SAFs are A, not very sustainable. They are an offset scheme and they're going to be always more expensive than hydrogen because for a synthetic fuel, right, biofuels are a little different. But for a synthetic fuel, hydrogen is a feedstock. Right. You produce hydrogen and then you sequester carbon from somewhere. Right. Like from direct air capture or whatever. And you combine the hydrogen and the carbon to create a synthetic hydrocarbon. Right, and that sucking up of carbon from the atmosphere is what creates the offsetting effect, right? To make it sustainable, quote unquote. But it will always cost more than hydrogen by definition, right? Because it is a carbon loop wrapped around a hydrogen molecule. And the reason that the industry is saying, oh no, well, SAFs are clearly the solution, right? Is because for hydrogen they have to change the airplane, they have to change the engine. And we as an industry have become very incrementalist and we prefer not to, right? And so this is what I've never taken for an acceptable answer. I will say that in fairness, I think SAFs are a very near-term solution because you don't have to change the airplane and the engine. So better than nothing. If somebody's willing to subsidize them or if travelers are willing to pay the fare, right? It is an offset scheme, right? But it's better than nothing. So please do that. And then for some missions, like very long-range missions, which are actually a pretty small fraction of aviation emissions, but for very long-range missions, hydrogen has a volume challenge. For the bulk of aviation missions, including the transcontinental missions within US, Europe, China, right, flown by A320s, flown by 737s today, you can absolutely do those missions with hydrogen. But if you're talking about global range, again, a very small fraction of all aviation emissions, you do need something different. That something could be SAF, of course, right? Or it could be things like ammonia or ammonia-hydrogen mixtures, right? Or other approaches to solving those. The good news, though, is that narrow-body or single-aisle class airplanes are the bulk of aviation emissions. They are squarely addressable with hydrogen, and they are due for a new airplane, both from Airbus and from Boeing, in the mid-2030s, which then gives you plenty of time for that airplane to penetrate the market and decarbonize the bulk of aviation emissions by 2050, which is sort of the Paris Agreement timeline. So there is a way. There is a way, right? But SAF is not the way.
And thank you for taking that question on. It was something I've been thinking about, you know, around the different technologies. Now let's address this specific point you mentioned, where you can actually address the bulk of emissions around single aisle aircraft. You're of course testing with right now the Dash 8 and then the ADR. What is your scale up plan? How is the testing? What does the roadmap look like from this Dash 8 to certification to ADR to a single aisle family like 737 or the A320 Neo or whatever they might call it?
Yeah. So the regional airplanes, right, the Dash 8 and the ATR, of course, are just a couple percent of aviation emissions, right? So they're not going to solve for the Paris Agreement. They're really a proof point. And they're a way of also convincing the public and the regulators, right, and everybody else that, hey, as soon as 2025, you'll be able to take a true zero emission flight. Right. And my hope is that as a result, people ask the question of like, well, but then why can't I have every flight be zero emissions? Right. Like what? Like it's clearly possible. It's safe. Right. We also want to get over this hump of passenger acceptance. Right. Because I think that a lot of people are like, oh, the Hindenburg. Right. Passengers will never get on a hydrogen airplane. Well, that's total baloney. Right. There are hydrogen cars on the roads of California, the Toyota Mirai. Right, there's quite a few of them, and nobody swerves off the road when they see MRI because they're worried about the Hindenburg, right? It's not a real thing, but you got to prove that, right? Nobody will take my word for it, and so I think there will be no difficulty getting passengers on hydrogen powered regional airplanes, and so I think it's a proof point from a regulatory and certification perspective, from a passenger acceptance perspective, and a proof point that we can in fact deliver hydrogen cost effectively to a variety of airports around the world, and then comes the single aisle. And the decision on the single aisle, right, both Boeing and Airbus have said loosely that it'll be a 2035 entry into service for a new clean sheet airplane in that segment to replace the 737 and the A320. And that means, if you backtrack from 2035, that it's probably a 2028, 2029 program launch, right? And so we are timing this very carefully, again, right? So we are in service in regional for a few years by the time they have to make that decision. And that has to be a clean sheet airplane. We're not going to retrofit A320s, right, to fly on hydrogen. It needs to be a new airplane. It needs to be a little bit different. It'll be a little bit longer. It'll still be a tube and wings. It doesn't have to be anything radical like a flying wing or blended wing body or anything like that. It'll be a slightly longer tube with hydrogen in the fuselage. It'll be a thinner wing because there's no fuel in the wings. As a result, the wing will be lighter. It'll be more aerodynamically efficient. You can do things like laminar flow on the wing, right? So there are some advantages to such a configuration. And our aspiration, again, is just to be a fuel services player. So there will be an OEM, an Airbus or a Boeing, and there will be an engine producer. And we see Airbus and GE as the front runners in that race, taking it the most seriously. GE is working on the RISE engine, which is a hydrogen burning engine. And so this is also the reason, of course, that both Airbus and GE are investors in Universal Hydrogen, right, is they see us as the third leg of the stool for a future potential single aisle application, right? We will solve the fuel logistics and the infrastructure problem for that aircraft.
I love how you work backwards on this from 2035. And I remember, yes, Boeing themselves have said 2035 for the new single aisle clean sheet design. And I see how the jigsaw pieces are fitting in the puzzle. Now, going back to an earlier point, you mentioned how costs and the infrastructure and the support in the US or even in Europe is getting there. But one of your other customers is now Air New Zealand, which is, you know, in one corner of the world. How are you going to make that? I mean, and how is that use case different from a Connect Airlines?
So it's actually not that different, right? Because we, so as I mentioned, we have 16 customers across 12 countries today. I think that number is going to grow very significantly in the next year or two. And we look for hydrogen production in the region in which the regional airline operates. And we prioritize our customers also in sequence of our ability to deliver affordable green hydrogen to them in the near term, right? So in the US, the IRA has really been transformative. So there's a huge amount of activity. And so we now have signed offtake agreements for Connect Air, right, to provide hydrogen at a given cost to Connect Air that's cost competitive with jet fuel. And we're similarly working in New Zealand with a local hydrogen producer, green hydrogen producer, right, to create a hydrogen delivery network for Air New Zealand. And we're doing that in few other parts of the world as well, right? So we're trying to pursue this simultaneously, right? So that we're not a one customer, can't be a one customer company.
I'm glad to hear that, and I'm sure there will be lessons being learned from different regions that you can apply as well. Now, one of your investors is JetBlue Ventures. We've had Amy Burr from JetBlue Ventures as well as Bonnie come on the podcast previously. Talk to us about how they have helped you beyond obviously just the funding. And are you doing any work with JetBlue, the airline itself?
Yeah, so JetBlue has been a fantastic investor. We have tried to assemble the entire hydrogen value chain for the future of aviation on our cap table, in our boardroom, basically, right? So we have Airbus, right? We have GE, right? We have hydrogen producers like Fortescue and Plug Power, right? Who are both investors in the company. And so their presence there. And then we have the end customers, which is JetBlue. We also have American Airlines as an investor, and Connect Air, in fact, is an investor as well. Right, so we from all the way from customer, right, for the hydrogen molecule goes all the way, right, through the engine, through the airplane to the customer, all in our boardroom. And so JetBlue has been an essential player there, and we have discussed a variety of things, right, for how do we, for instance, catalyze this end vision of a single aisle. So JetBlue doesn't fly ATR-72s today, right? We've talked about should you, would you, could you. But they certainly don't today. That's a fact. But they are a major single aisle operator, right? And we've certainly discussed what sorts of things beyond the ATR would be catalytic to a hydrogen single aisle, right? And for instance, should we do a demonstrator at the single aisle scale of some sort? And so that's something that JetBlue has been very catalytic to.
It's interesting how you've got, you know, the entire life cycle on your cap table. How is working with JetBlue Ventures different from, let's say, an investor like Airbus or Connect Air on the board itself or on as your cap table?
Yeah, I think JetBlue and a couple of other investors have navigated really well this distinction in the venture capital world, that there were this dichotomy that typically exists between a corporate venture fund, right, what's called the CVC, and a pure financial VC, right? And typically, you know, pure financial VCs are purely financially motivated. They have no domain expertise, right? But they move really fast. They can make decisions. They have a lot of flexibility, right, in the terms and the checks they write, right, and things like that. And then on the opposite end, you have the corporate venture arms, which are very slow, very bureaucratic, require a huge amount of sponsorship within the company, right? Alignment of stakeholders, right? Take forever to make a decision and then write you a tiny little check, right? That's been the dichotomy. And there is a few that have done a really good job of finding a place in between those two, right? And bringing the best of both worlds, of behaving like a proper Silicon Valley VC, right? So having decisional autonomy, moving quickly, right? Really understanding the ecosystem, right? But also bringing that corporate alignment, right? Domain expertise and those things. And I think this is what JetBlue has done extremely well. In fact, I'll say, so I was at Airbus when JetBlue Ventures was created, and we were just in the process of creating Airbus Ventures. And we took the JetBlue playbook because we thought they were doing it very, very well. And so a lot of how Airbus Ventures works, and of course, it's evolved quite a bit since the days when I was there. But we really looked to them because I think they were one of the first, if not the first, to really get that formula right. So they're a pleasure to work with, right? Because they bring you the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear this because I remember, around that time, Hangar 51 was just starting up at IAG. There was JetBlue Ventures around that time. There were just a couple here and there. So, and then Airbus Ventures was, I think, one of the first five as well in the industry. Now, you've, of course, raised a lot of money. A lot of it is focused on retrofitting, transport, you know, movement of hydrogen. Are you looking at potentially ever raising more to develop your own clean sheet aircraft by yourself?
So no, because as I said, our aspiration is to solve the hydrogen value chain problem, right? Is and there's a lot of people who want to build hydrogen airplanes. There's a lot of people who want to build engines for hydrogen airplanes, right? And there's nobody who wants to be a hydrogen fuel services provider. And so in terms of addressing an unmet need, we are very happy with this niche that we think we figured out a very elegant way of addressing. Right, we have very strong intellectual property and competitive moats around the solution, and so we see that as a great business for Universal Hydrogen. If we get into the airplane business, we're competing with our own customers. Why do that?
That's fair enough. Looking at just then retrofitting, right? That in itself is a very large market. What is the market size? What is the market you're targeting here? Retrofitting initially turboprops and then potentially single aisle aircraft itself.
So just to be clear, we would never retrofit a single aisle. I don't think that's a feasible proposition, right? It would be a new clean sheet airplane. It would be done by Boeing or Airbus, right? With an engine from a GE or a Rolls-Royce, right? And us as a modular fuel services partner, right? And again, I think that airplane would look different, right? The reason I don't think you would retrofit is because I don't think you can fly an A320 with empty wings. Right. And also you would have to store the hydrogen basically where the useful load carrying capacity of the aircraft is today. So instead you would do a clean sheet airplane that would be longer, would have a place to accommodate the fuselage and would have, dry wings, right? So a thin wing specifically designed for that with all the advantages of that. So the retrofits in the regional segment are, as I said, we do by necessity. Right, it's our first coffee maker for the coffee capsule, so to speak. And here we also, what we actually develop is a retrofit conversion kit. The kit consists of the fuel cell stacks, electric motor, compressors, thermal management system, computer software, right? All of that stuff. And that kit we then deploy to the airline or to an airline's chosen MRO. And so some of the bigger airlines have an in-house MRO, maintenance, repair, and overhaul capability. Smaller airlines will use a third party. We deploy the kit, and the MRO, the in-house or external MRO, is who installs the kit, right? So we don't actually do the aircraft modifications ourselves. That's pretty common for this class of airplanes because you can't really ferry the airplanes, right? It takes it's very hard to ferry regional airplanes. And so you want to do in theater, right, in region services, right? So you have to farm them out to third parties. That, of course, also helps us because then we don't have to build the infrastructure for doing conversions of hundreds and hundreds of airplanes. Right? We rely on third parties to do that. We just do the kitting of the kit, right, and the certification associated with it. Of course, we will support the MROs in terms of training, in terms of developing work packages for them and work instructions, right, and things like that for how to do the installation properly.
Do you ever foresee yourself offering line fit capability as well so that brand new aircraft are being rolled off the factory floor with your kit, be it Airbus or Boeing or someone else?
Yeah, of course. And I guess in the regional segment, it would be the ATRs and de Havillands of the world. We didn't want to do that as the first product because then we would be dependent on them and we wanted to have a fully permissionless business model, right? So today we can just go to the airline directly to the airline. There is no intermediary. And we say, we convert your fleet, we provide fuel services for your fleet, okay? And so that's a much easier proposition, right? We have to convince fewer people. And it's also much more convincing to investors if we have this permissionless business model, whereas somebody else doesn't hold the sword of Damocles over you, right? Now, in the long run, of course, or even long run, in the medium term, I will say, right, of course, airlines want to be able to get brand new airplanes equipped with our kit. And so those are conversations that we're having with the OEMs, of course, is when and to what point has it been de-risked sufficiently for them to line fit this capability. But it'll come.
Got it. So that's definitely on the cards. Let's look at the wider ecosystem in terms of just hydrogen here. I've had Val Miftikoff on the show as well from ZeroAvia. He admires what you're doing. Do you see ZeroAvia as competition, co-opetition? What's your take on ZeroAvia and their technology, and is it complementary to what you're doing?
Yeah, so I my understanding of what their aspiration is to be an engine company, right? Is they want to be a hydrogen powertrain company, and we think that's fantastic, right? Like I think that helps us sell more hydrogen into the ecosystem, right? So we certainly wish them much success. I think they're targeting a slightly smaller segment. I think they talk about bigger aircraft, right? But from what we can see of the technology that they're developing, which I think has a battery in between the fuel cell and the electric motor, that buffer battery can be helpful in some ways, but it's not scalable. Once you get to a certain class, right, in the megawatts, the buffer battery gets so large, and also you're charging and discharging it at such a fast rate that it becomes consumable. It starts affecting your unit economics. So you have to design that out, right? So I do think that there is a different technological approach that we're pursuing, and we're targeting, I think they've flown, what, a Dornier 228, right, which is a 19-seater, and we're targeting much more the 40, 50, 60-seater class at the moment. And what we flew in March was the 40, it's a 40 seater configured Dash 8-300, right? So I think the powertrain work that we're doing is complementary because it's two different segments. But in the long run, our business models are fundamentally different, right? Like we're a fuel services company and they're an engine company.
Got it. Thank you for that perspective. Now, what do you say to hydrogen skeptics? There are lots of incrementalists within aviation who are stuck to a certain identity, having spent their entire career within a certain aspect of aviation. And they're like, oh no, hydrogen just won't work. And I'm not sure if the arguments are strong or correct, but how do you get back to the skeptics?
Well, I think it depends what the line of argument from the skeptics is, right? And I think there's a few, right? There's the Hindenburg crowd, there is the SAF crowd, right? There is the there won't be enough hydrogen crowd. I think there are very, very good answers to all of those lines of skepticism. So it depends. But, you know, I was doing an interview with PBS NewsHour, and I guess it hasn't aired yet. It should air sometime this summer. But the interviewer, I was sort of describing this, right? And I was saying, like, look, because he was saying that, like, you know, Airbus seems to be pro-hydrogen. Boeing, not so much, right? I think the Boeing chief sustainability officer got up at some industry analyst day, right, and said, never, right, blah, blah, blah. We don't see this as realistic until the 2100s or something, or 2050s, right? So, like a very long time from now. And so I was sort of describing this and saying that there really needs to be a generational change in a lot of these companies, right? If you look at the Boeing C-suite, it's a decade, probably on average, maybe a decade and a half older than the Airbus C-suite. And the Airbus C-suite was sort of refreshed and rejuvenated when Guillaume Faury came in as CEO. And so I think they bring a very different cultural context, right? Just a different generational view. And by the time the single aisle decision has to be made, my expectation is that the Boeing C-suite also has a new cast of characters in it, right? And so the interviewer from PBS said, so what you're saying, Paul, is that you got to get the fossils out of the wing, but you also got to get the fossils out of the C-suite. And I was like, that's perfect. Thank you. If I thought of it myself, I would.
You didn't say it. I didn't say it.
So reference PBS.
All right. That's fair. Now, Paul, you've had a very, very interesting career path getting you to Universal Hydrogen. Specifically, you were CTO at Airbus. You have worked with UTC and the engine manufacturer, on the engine side. What are some of the experiences in those companies, specifically Airbus and UTC, that you're applying now in Universal Hydrogen that is either allowing you to avoid some pitfalls or second, you know, scale up faster than you would have had you not had these experiences?
Well, I think the most obvious one is the fact that we created this company specifically to address a very clear pain point and gap in the value chain, an unsolved niche in the value chain. And so I think the perspective I had from Airbus, right? So when I was at Airbus, I would be like, well, what about hydrogen airplane? Can we do a hydrogen airplane? What would prevent us, right? Let's look at the history, right? Well, the Soviets did a hydrogen airplane, right? It's been done, right? Why can't we do that again? What are the big issues, right? And one of the questions that arose was, well, there's no engine, right? There's no engine and there's no hydrogen. So then I went to an engine maker, right? UTC. And I was like, well, when I was at Airbus, we thought there was no hydrogen engine. What would it take for us to build a hydrogen engine? Oh, look, it turns out that actually UT Pratt & Whitney used to build hydrogen engines in the 50s. It was a thing. Like, we know how to do this. Maybe the people are retired, right? But the DNA, it's very much in the DNA of the company, right? So we can build a hydrogen engine if Airbus asks for it. Okay, great. Good to know. So you can do the airplane, we can do the engine. What's missing? Well, what's missing is the infrastructure, right? There is no hydrogen. So how do you get the hydrogen? And so that was sort of a very obvious confluence of the two experiences at Airbus and at UTC that led us to create this company. Is to sort of and try to address all of the things that I would have said when I was CTO at Airbus, right? If a startup came to me and said, well, you know, let's do hydrogen aviation, right? I would say, well, what about, right? Certification basis and passenger acceptance and this and this and this, right? And so we now try to tick off all of the things that the Airbuses of the world would want answered, right? In our this permissionless product demonstrator, right, that we're trying to do in the regional segment, so that they have no excuse when the discussion comes to the single aisle.
What's interesting to note, though, is while Airbus now does have a strong hydrogen program, futuristic, looking out in the future, it's GE, which is UTC's competitor, you're working
this
with.
This is true.
An investor.
This is true. I can only change so many hearts and minds. Yeah. But I think this has always been true, right? I think that Pratt and Whitney and UTC and Raytheon to some extent are very by the numbers companies, right? And a by the numbers company will always tend towards incrementalism, right? And say, okay, we have profitable franchises, we have unprofitable franchises. How do we tweak the unprofitable ones to make them profitable? Right? You know, that sort of thing. Versus, I think, like companies like Airbus and I think GE to some extent, which are much more vision focused, right? And I'm not saying they don't have good financials. Of course, the financials have to be there, right? But I think in terms of leadership style, and this was a big difference for me, right? Coming from Airbus, which was led by Tom Enders at the time, and Tom is a visionary, big idea guy, you know, loves everything about aviation, jumps out of airplanes with a parachute himself, right? I think he was still the first parachutist to jump out of an A400M. Right, the new military aircraft that Airbus was developing, and then coming to UTC, which was led by Greg Hayes, who is a former CFO and an accountant, right, and has a very different perspective on how to build the future of the business. And so I think that actually is probably the reason that we see GE taking much more of a leadership position in the space than Pratt.
Fair enough, and that's a nice, you know, behind the scenes look at the organizations. One organization that I think at least the aviation folks do not know about that you've actually worked with is Google. You were working on the modular phone design when you were at Google. Any lessons you're applying from your time at Google or how Google did things so that you're doing things differently at Universal?
Yeah, well, you know, I've told people I've made a career out of modularity, right? But just applying the concept of modularity, which I think is an underappreciated concept. And the reason it's underappreciated is because whenever you make a modular system, right, it's going to weigh more or perform worse, right? It's going to have some penalty associated with modularity versus a tightly integrated monolithic system, right? Like that's regardless of the domain of application, right? I think that's a truism. And most of our systems engineering tools, again, across all domains, right, are focused on eking out maximum performance, lowest cost, maximum performance, lowest cost. What modularity buys you is flexibility. Right. And all the illities, right? Flexibility, adaptability, maintainability, survivability, sustainability, right? All under the rubric of, you could call, flexibility of the system. And we're not actually very good at design for flexibility. Again, we are good at design for performance, design for cost, but not design for flexibility. And so modularity usually gets discounted, right? Because it suboptimizes the system against a performance cost kind of view of the world, but it improves the flexibility. And so I've made a career out of trying to inject modularity forcibly, right, where I see heuristically that flexibility is going to be valuable. And so my first sort of foray into modularity was actually at DARPA, and I worked on modular satellite architectures, right? It was a program called System F6. It was called fractionated satellites, right, where you would break up large complex satellites into clusters, right, little free-flying clusters of smaller pieces, right? And they would have to have a communication protocol, an operating system, right? We looked at power transfer even and force and torque transfer. Like, I mean, we did a lot around this concept. And that was the first, and we actually built a pretty strong analytic framework for trying to value and quantify flexibility, the value of flexibility in those kinds of systems. And then I went from DARPA to Motorola and then Google. Motorola was just acquired by Google and then sold very quickly. And worked on the same principle for smartphones, right? Where again, a modular smartphone was going to be thicker, it was going to be heavier, it was going to have worse battery life, but it would have this open ecosystem of developers to create custom hardware modules, right, with sensors, right, or whatever other better communications, better this, better that, right, or pharmaceutical modules for testing blood glucose, right. We had a lot of really crazy developer ideas, right, and these are third-party developers in the same way that you have third-party app developers for in the App Store, both for Android and for iOS, except they can now develop hardware that plugs into your phone seamlessly, right. But your phone has worse battery life, weighs more, and is a little bit thicker, right? We still made it beautiful, I think. If you look at some of the old pictures of our, I think even to today's eye, you know, recognizing that it was some time ago and our design aesthetic evolves, I think is still quite a beautiful design. And so you bought all of this flexibility and the power of this open third-party ecosystem of developers. And now we're working on hydrogen modules for fueling. By the way, there was one other, by the way, we did modular cabins at Airbus. We did a project on modular cabin configurations, right? So you could rapidly reconfigure a cabin inside an airplane for a particular route. So you could optimize it for passengers sleeping or passengers working, or you could put a gambling module on a route to Vegas, right, or whatever into the cabin. So it's basically a cargo airplane, but you would load cabin modules as cargo into this aircraft and configure a unique cabin experience for a given flight. So and so now we're working on modular fueling. And again, everybody's always like, but if you build in the tank into the airplane, it's going to weigh 0.5% less or 1% less, right? Probably true, right? But you lose this whole compatibility with intermodal freight, the flexibility of, right? And so so I've made a whole career out of it, right? And so sorry for the long answer, but that's probably the biggest connection I can draw from what I did at Google to what I'm doing today, right, is this notion that modularity is an underappreciated architectural concept across many, many fields.
Fantastic. Thank you for that long answer. You know, it's the depth that matters, and I can totally see how you're bringing modularity into aviation now. Paul, I'm very curious, why are you so motivated to solve this sustainability problem for aviation? What is your deep emotional reason here?
Well, so look, if you look at aviation, right? So first of all, aviation emissions are about the size of Germany, right? So all of aviation puts out about as much pollution or CO2, right, as the country of Germany. So it's sizable. It's not the biggest, right? But it is a sizable contribution. And aviation is one of the worst problems of its own making, right? It is a victim of its own success. So the reason that aviation is an outlier across all of the different spaces, in that if you actually look at true projections, aviation emissions will grow on the time horizon of the Paris Agreement, right? And then so we do a little dance and we say we're going to buy offsets and do SAFs, right, and all of that, right? But in reality, aviation traffic volumes double every 15 years, and this is a law of nature. In the industry, it is a law of nature. So it goes back to the jet age, the birth of the jet age. And if you look at 9/11, right, there was a little dip, right? And then it went right back to this exponential 15-year doubling time. If you look at COVID, there was a dip, and then we went right back to this exponential doubling time. So it is an immutable law on which this industry is predicated, and all of the valuations of all of the companies and the stock prices, right, and everything is predicated on aviation traffic volumes doubling every 15 years. So if they stop doubling every 15 years, it will be an economic calamity for the aerospace industry. The problem is that airplane efficiency, right, so improvements in aerodynamics and engines and structures, right, and all of the standard ways in which we improve efficiency doubles every 30 years. And so you have two exponentials, but one is much slower than the other. And so as a result, aviation emissions grow, and they have always grown. They are set to grow, and they will continue to grow because there is no disruptive technology on the horizon, which is going to drastically improve efficiency. And so. The only real credible way that we have to reduce aviation emissions is to reduce traffic growth, right? And I think this will be terrible for the industry, but I also think it'll be bad for the world. Like one of the reasons I'm in aviation is because I think it's one of the greatest forces for good in the history of our species, right? Because it's created a huge amount of economic opportunity. It's the key driver of globalization, of cultural interchange, of the creation of global multinational companies, right? And I think it's one of the biggest drivers of peace and prosperity. And so stifling that, I think, is a terrible way to solve the climate crisis, right? And so the only other thing you can do is you can substitute the fuel, right? I can't think of any other options, right? And if you substitute the fuel and you look at the list of fuels, hydrogen is right at the top because it's the lightest energy carrier outside of nuclear fuels, and aviation is the most weight-sensitive application. This is why hydrogen is already a fuel that gets used for rockets, not for any environmental reason, but because it's a very, very weight-efficient energy carrier. And so similar, so it's a very simple story, right? You want aviation to continue to prosper. To do that, you don't want to reduce traffic volume, so something else has to give in order to decarbonize. And a fuel substitution, you look at the list of fuels and hydrogen's at the top. So let's try to make it work. So that's where it comes from.
Fantastic. I'm inspired and I'm encouraged. I wish I can, you know, come work with you tomorrow. It would be so exciting. To wrap up the interview, I have what's called a rapid fire round. I'm going to ask you 5 questions with 1 word answers is what I'm expecting from you. Very, very simple. You have not seen these questions before, so we'll keep it light and fun. We'll start easy. What's your favorite movie?
Oh, boy. That's actually a surprisingly difficult question. I would say Fellini's Satyricon. Sorry, it's a little esoteric, but Federico Fellini's Satyricon.
Okay.
One of my favorite movies.
I'm going to check it out. What's your favorite book?
Asimov's Foundation Trilogy.
Okay, fantastic. What's your favorite airline?
So, look, I don't have a one-word answer. I can't give you a one-word answer for that one because I don't want to offend any of my investors. But I think certainly the Middle Eastern carriers, Emirates and Etihad, have really, really, really perfected the in-flight travel experience.
Okay. What's your favorite city?
L.A.
Okay, Los Angeles, and you live there now. That's fantastic. What is something you want to learn, Paul?
Well, one of the things that I'm working on today is my instrument rating as a pilot, right? So I started flying actually before I learned to drive. I learned to fly, got my pilot's license before I got my driver's license, and flew for a little bit, then haven't flown for many years, and now working on my instrument rating.
Fantastic. All the best for that. Who do you look up to?
I've been fortunate to have a few mentors in my career, but probably the biggest and most influential on me is a woman named Regina Dugan, who was the DARPA director in the first Obama administration. When I was at DARPA, she was the DARPA director, and later she was my boss at Motorola and at Google. And she's been very influential to the way that I think about technology and innovation.
Fantastic. And final question, what is the best advice you've received?
I think probably the best piece of advice is don't predict the future, but make the future. It's a little bit of a cliche, right? But I think it's true, right? If you want something to be different in the world, it's nobody else's job but yours to go and try to figure out a way to make it so.
Well said. You're definitely creating the future here, and I do wish you all the best. This is very exciting, and Paul, thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Mira Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Lihia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.